afternoon, listeners. This is the Dogs Program. The Australian Council for Defence of Government Schools have been here. Well, we've been around since the 60s fighting for public education. There's been a lot in the news in last week about the 75 dismissal. Well, we were even there before that. And of course, a lot of the problems started in that time when they set up the Schools Commission. Or certainly in the 60s, they started giving state aid back to the private schools. And we were set up then to oppose it. And here we are, we still oppose state aid for private schools because the funding figures are very interesting indeed. And in the last few weeks, we've been telling you a lot about these figures that have recently come out of Canberra with Trevor Cobbald, and he's now becoming quite respectable. People are quoting him in the paper and also in important reports. But just to remind you of these figures, the Educator also had an article by Henneberry in it, which quoted the figures, and here they are again. Just keep them in your mind. Andy's going to give them to you.
Thanks, Jean. New report reignites school funding a fairness debate. And this was written by Brett Henneberry and published on the 10th of November. Australia's public schools lost more than $2 billion in 2023 after state and territory governments used accounting tricks to claim the money under non-SRS expenses, according to an analysis of a new report on school funding. While all governments must meet minimum SRS contributions under federal-state funding agreements, the report found all jurisdictions except the ACT included non-SRS items like transport, depreciation, and admin costs in their totals. The review by the National School Resourcing Board, the NSRB, found $2.34 billion in these non-SRS expenditures were claimed by states in 2023. Public education advocacy group Save Our Schools, SOS, previously estimated a similar figure at $2.35 billion. Because this spending does not increase school resources, the practice reduced real funding to public schools. The largest reductions in public school funding occurred in New South Wales, $641 million, Victoria, $628 million, and Queensland, $568 million. Losses in Western Australia and South Australia were $237 million and $171 million, respectively. It is abominable that state governments continue to refuse to fully fund public schools, which are their primary responsibility, while continuing to overfund private schools, SOS National Convener Trevor Cobbold said. It is another indication of the extent to which the school funding system is biased against public schools. Cobbold said the discrimination in favour of private schools runs even deeper. State governments defrauded public schools by claiming non-SRS expenditures such as depreciation, school transport, and expenditure on regulatory authorities as part of their share of funding public schools, he said. However, they did not claim such expenditures as part of their share of funding private schools. Cobbold said private school students also received school transport subsidies, and being regulated by state government authorities is yet another way in which the school funding system is biased against public schools. And that is indeed a national disgrace. Back to you, Jean.
Well, thank you, Andy. I think people must remember too that private schools are very dependent upon the universities, the public universities, and also the public schools for teachers. And it's diabolical in Australia, where now we have a great shortage of teachers. Let's hear about it, shall we?
Thanks, Jean. Diabolical. Why Australia's teacher shortages are among the worst in the world, and who is suffering most? Regional and disadvantaged schools are bearing the brunt of the crisis, with almost two-thirds of teachers reporting high levels of stress. And this was published in The Guardian, written by Caitlin Cassidy, on the 3rd of November. Matthew Burt has been principal at Broome Senior High School for less than a decade, yet he's one of the longest serving school leaders across the Kimberley. After spending most of his teaching career in Perth, Burt decided to make the tree change north in 2018 with his wife and two children. He said teacher shortages have hit all of Western Australia, but the more regional you go, the worse the crisis gets. You go to some metropolitan areas where you see teachers and principals that are in schools for 15 years or more, he said. When you've got principals changing over every few months, like in some regional or remote areas, it's just an unknown, and the trust and confidence of the community in that school drops as a result. Australia's teacher shortages are among the worst in the world, an international report has found, and disadvantaged and remote schools are suffering the most. The OECD Teaching and Learning International Survey, TALIS, released this month, found 4 in 10, 42%, lower secondary principals in Australia agreed that a shortage of teachers in their school hindered the quality of instruction, almost double the OECD average of 23%, and up from 14% in 2018. Matthew Burt, the principal of Broome Senior High School, says regional areas are particularly suffering from teacher shortages. Australia also recorded the largest shortage of staff in regional schools, 63%, and in disadvantaged schools, 67%, which are defined as having more than 30% of students from socioeconomically struggling homes. The convener of Save Our Schools, Trevor Cobbold, said the report demonstrates that Australia is facing a diabolical staffing crisis. The increased shortage restricts learning in schools, especially in disadvantaged public schools, he said. It is a major obstacle to reducing the large achievement gaps between the rich and the poor. Australian teachers are working an average of 46.5 hours per week, the report found, well above the OECD average of 40.8 hours, with almost two-thirds experiencing high stress, 65%, and 80% saying their job negatively affects their mental health. The results echo a University of New South Wales study released in August, which found teachers experienced depression, anxiety, and stress at three times the national norm, closely linked to their workload. According to the Australian Institute for Teaching and School Leadership, about 30% of teachers are considering leaving the profession before retirement age. In WA alone, 1,279 teachers resigned in 2024-25, Department of Education figures showed, the highest number since data began being published in 2005. The president of the Australian Education Union, Corinna Haythorpe, said the scale of the problem is unacceptable for a wealthy developed nation. She said shortages began to escalate 3 years ago as Australia emerged from the pandemic and prospective teachers reconsidered entering the profession, whilst others reconsidered how long they would stay. She says the source of the crisis has been brewing for some time. We've had a public education system which has been so starved of resources that teachers carry that burden because you don't want to let any child down. A report by the Australian Primary Principals Association released last month canvassed principals at schools that had lost specialist subjects such as music, language and arts, support for students with disabilities, and suffered from attendance dips as a result of teacher shortages. Every day starts with a spreadsheet of who's absent and ends with wondering how much longer we can keep this up, a regional principal said in the report. At the end of 2022, education ministers agreed to a National Teacher Workforce Action Plan to address shortages, focusing on supply, education, elevating the profession, and retainment. Since then, there's been a 7% increase in annual applications to teaching degrees, and changes to teacher training have been announced. Individual states have also experienced some wins. In New South Wales, for instance, public school vacancies have dropped by 61% in 3 years, with 962 unfilled teaching positions in Term 3 of 2025, compared with 2,460 at the same time in 2022. The shift was largely attributed to a pay deal secured by teachers in 2023 to become among the highest remunerated in the country, and dedicated recruitment officers at every school. Haythorpe praised what was occurring at the beginning of the pipeline, but said funding is just as critically important. It should be used to address escalating workloads to make sure we've got more educational support personnel so that we can alleviate burden from teachers and give them time to teach in the classroom, she said. Burt also acknowledged minor wins, including incentives in WA for student teachers to complete placements in regional schools, but he said that does not help with continuity, which not only affects student performance, but also community cohesion. Burt's daughter has recently started in a teaching degree and is benefiting from government scholarships and paid practical placements. Her career trajectory is likely to be very different from her father's. When I first came into teaching, I pretty much had to go to a country area for my first posting, he said. My daughter will walk into a job at any one of those primary schools in the metropolitan area where she lives. We need a whole of country approach to this issue now, because right now we're just pinching teachers from each other. The schools that are less desirable are ending up with worse shortages, and we're creating more of a problem. Back to you, Jane.
Well, thank you so much for that. Let's have a bit of a break, shall we?
Help us stay radical. Become a regular donor to 3CR. A regular donor is someone who loves 3CR so much that they set up an automatic donation to 3CR on the same day every month. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au.
Looking for an easy way to keep up with your annual 3CR subscription? You can now set up an annual debit from your bank account or credit card, and once a year your payment will be automatically deducted. You can cancel at any time and you'll get a reminder each year before payment. Be a constant supporter of Melbourne's precious independent community radio station and set up a recurring payment today. Just go to 3cr.org.au/subscribe.
Well, you're still listening to the Dogs program, I hope, because in the Age in the last week, there's been quite a bit about this, the fee hike by the private schools. You know, that lot along the Glenferrie Road in Hawthorne. Even though they get our taxpayers' dollars, they're still hiking up their fees beyond inflation and crying poor because, like state schools, they have to pay payroll tax. Let's hear about it, shall we?
Thanks, Jean. This article was written by Noel Towell, Jackson Graham and Nicole Purcell for The Age and is entitled Private Schools Hike Fees by Thousands of Dollars. Parents at some of Melbourne's top private schools will have to find thousands of dollars more for their children's education next year, as tuition fees at some institutions soar by more than twice the rate of inflation. One school, St. Kevin's College, has increased Year 12 tuition charges by 16% for 2026. But even after the $5,000 annual increase, the Toorak institution will remain considerably more affordable than most of its peer schools. St. Kevin's has outpaced other nearby private schools in raising fees by 16%. An analysis of the charges from the high-fee schools that have published their 2026 rates show their average fees increasing by $2,146, or nearly 5% from this year, well above the headline inflation rate of 3.2%. Geelong Grammar looks set to remain the state's most expensive school next year. Year 12 fees will push past $55,000 for 2026, up 5.2% on this year. The school's fees are more than 10% more than the next most costly, Wesley College, which will charge just under $50,000. Toorak's Loretto Mandeville Hall has increased its fees, including a compulsory $3,000 building levy, by more than 8.5% to nearly $43,000. Fees at Rutan Girls School will increase by 6.4%, while at St. Michael's Grammar they will rise by 6.1%. The largest increase reported so far is at St. Kevin's College, where Year 12 fees will increase by 16%, from $30,360 to $35,360, with a $1,200 building levy charged on top. But parents at the sought-after Catholic school were told last week that they would still be paying considerably less than families at other members of the Associated Public Schools group, which includes Geelong Grammar and Wesley. St. Kevin's also told families that the state government's controversial payroll tax on private schools was expected to cost the school $3.3 million next year. A pay rise of at least 7% for Catholic school teachers across Victoria next year, and the need to ensure long-term financial stability at the Turek institution, had also helped to push up fees, parents were told. A St. Kevin's spokesman said the school's academic success reflected the resources devoted to senior students there. The ongoing excellence in VCE results is a direct outcome of an international commitment and also resourcing of senior students to achieve their best, the spokesman said. In 2026, this requires an adjusted price point of less than $500 per term at Year 12 after all other factors are considered. Bavika Unadkat, Victorian board member of the Australian Parents Council, said families were distressed about the increase in fees, and some were taking extra jobs or choosing which child to keep in private education. In some cases, parents were being made redundant in a tough job market. It is very, very difficult for parents to just manage the increase in fees, she said. Unadkat said she knew of parents who have had to move their primary school age child into the public system to keep their first child in an independent school for Year 12. Education economist Adam Roris, who has been studying the sector's funding in Australia and overseas for 20 years, said fee inflation at private schools was more about prestige than cost pressures. I understand it as simply an exercise in creating prestige. That means prestige via exclusion, he said. Parents who could afford it at one stage but now can't, or find it very difficult to afford, are simply experiencing what that funding system is intended to produce, an exclusionary effect on those that don't have the money. The system is working very well for what it's intended to do. Roris said many of the wealthier schools were putting money they had saved aside to build an underground swimming pool or elaborate football oval. They are manufacturing expenditure that's not related to delivering high-quality education, he said. It's expenditure that's designed to promote and advertise exclusivity. He questioned the value in governments continuing to support private schools with funding. I think the situation is now beyond a joke, he said. Independent Schools Australia's recent report showed enrolments had continued to rise every year for the past 8 years, despite fee increases, climbing to 18% of enrolments across Australia in 2024. Back over to you, Jean.
Well, thank you very much, Sol. It's great to have you back. And now the AEU, that's the Australian Education Union, have been quite active in the last few weeks, and they're involved in protests, which we'll be talking about a bit later. And they're calling for targeted investment to meet the needs of every child throughout Australia, most particularly those in public schools, of course.
Thanks, Jean. AEU calls for targeted investment to meet the needs of every child. And this is from the 4th of November. The Australian Education Union has today released Investing in Australia's Future 2025, a comprehensive report outlining the urgent reforms and targeted investments needed to ensure every child in every public school can thrive. The report, grounded in evidence from thousands of teachers, principals and education support staff across 6,700 public schools, provides a clear roadmap for how governments can deliver on the goals of the Better and Fairer Schools Agreement 2025 to 2034, the first national agreement in a decade to commit to full and fair funding for every public school. AEU Federal President Corina Haythorpe said the findings highlight both the extraordinary dedication of public school staff and the scale of the challenges they face. The teaching profession remains in crisis. Teachers are overworked, burnt out, and struggling to meet the growing complexity of student needs with inadequate resources, Ms. Haythorpe said. Thanks to AEU members' ongoing campaigning, governments have committed more than $20 billion to public schools nationally. This report makes clear that to lift outcomes for all students, we must use that investment to reduce class sizes, increase one-on-one support for students, and cut the sustainable workloads driving teacher shortages. Key findings of the report include rising student needs. 95% of principals and teachers say student diversity and complexity have increased in the last 3 years, driven by mental health, disability, and behavioural challenges. Workload crisis. 55% of teachers report burnout, with excessive administrative tasks and teacher shortages exacerbating unmanageable workloads. Equity gaps. Public schools educate 90% of students from low socioeconomic backgrounds, 82% of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander students, and 67% of students with disability, yet remain chronically underfunded. Infrastructure divide. One elite private school spent more on capital works in 2021 than Tasmania and the NT governments combined spent on all public schools. And teacher shortage. 3/4 of principals report shortages, and only 1 in 5 teachers plan to stay until retirement. The AEU has outlined a suite of solutions for governments to act on these critical issues, including permanent small group tutoring and smaller class sizes to the OECD average of 21, with more education support staff. 150 full-service schools in disadvantaged communities offering integrated health and family services. More Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander teachers and culturally responsive teaching practices. 2 extra hours a week for planning and collaboration, more admin staff, and a national early career guarantee. More school counsellors, social workers, and system-wide support for evidence-based wellbeing programs. A permanent Commonwealth Capital Fund to ensure every public school has modern, inclusive, and accessible facilities. The $20 billion committed through the Better and Fairer Schools Agreement is a once-in-a-generation opportunity to rebuild the foundations of public education. But to truly deliver for every child, we must invest in what works, which is smaller class sizes, additional support staff, full-service schools, and the time teachers need to teach, Ms. Haythorpe said. With Victoria the only state or territory in the nation not to have agreed funding arrangements through to 2034, the Victorian government's decision not to deliver any additional funding until 2031 will leave public schools at least $2.4 billion worse off unless the decision is reversed. Proper allocation of public school funding is the key to closing the achievement gap and giving every child the opportunity to thrive. This is a historic opportunity to create a stronger, fairer, and better education system for every child in every public school in every community. Back to you, Jean.
Well, thank you very much, Andy. We're going to take you over to America because America is trying to develop what we've got in Australia. State aid to private schools is really a form of what they call a voucher system. They talk a lot about the money following the child. And over there in Florida, they have quite a big voucher system. Most of the states of America have rejected it in the same way they have rejected the charter school movement. But in Florida, the officials have got this voucher system, and now they're very upset because there's lots of money going to an Islamic school. Let's hear about it.
Thanks, Jean. Florida officials created a universal school voucher plan, and now they're furious that Islamic schools are participating. And this was published on November the 3rd, and it was written by Rob Boston from Americans United for Separation of Church and State. A basic rule of American church-state law is that government must treat all religions equally. If a benefit is extended to one faith group, it must be made available to all. A law that establishes a special program but limits it to Christian churches will not pass constitutional muster. Amazingly, the Attorney General of Florida does not seem to understand this. James Uthmeyer, who is, let's remember, the top legal official in the state, recently went on a tear because he is apparently just learning that Islamic schools are taking part in the state's private school voucher program. Just to back up a minute, Florida has had a voucher program for decades. Early on, the plan was limited to low-income residents and students with certain types of learning challenges. But 2 years ago, the state lawmakers made it universal. Now, basically, any student in the Sunshine State can get a voucher to attend a private school. Most of the private schools taking part in the program are Christian, but not surprisingly, other religions are getting in on the game. Among them, Islamic academies. Some Muslims who run Islamic schools made videos focusing on what their schools offer and boosting the idea of Islamic education generally. An anti-Muslim activist posted these videos to X/Twitter and, with absolutely no evidence, accused the schools of promoting terrorism and Sharia, a set of Islamic principles that some Muslim countries have codified into law, and that Christian nationalists often use as a bogeyman to justify anti-Muslim bias. Wild claims, but no evidence. Utmeyer shared the tweet, as did Florida Agriculture Commissioner Wilton Simpson. Simpson, who used to be president of the state Senate, said he supports vouchers but insisted that schools that indoctrinate Sharia law should not be part of our taxpayer-funded school voucher program. When the Orlando Sentinel asked Utmeyer for evidence that these schools were teaching Sharia law, it got no response. Rabbi Merrill Shapiro, past president of Americans United's Board of Trustees and a Florida resident, properly labelled this as bigoted. In an interview with The Sentinel, Shapiro added, "Sadly, bigotry against Islam is epidemic." But Shapiro went on to make an important point. This would not be an issue if that state hadn't created the voucher plan. Public funds for public schools. It would be far better for all of us if the government would stay out of the religious school business and leave our taxpayer dollars for what they are intended, not to support religious education, Shapiro said. Well said. There are a lot of problems with vouchers, chief among them that they violate the separation of church and state and present an existential threat to our public schools. But Florida officials can hardly complain about what's going on there. They created this plan, probably hoping to boost private Christian education, and now some non-Christian religious schools are taking part as they have a legal right to do. Utmeyer needs some remedial instruction in the law regarding equal treatment. He also needs to learn that no amount of bigotry or ill-considered, patently unconstitutional laws that would ban Islamic schools from the voucher program will get Florida out of the mess it has created with education. There's only one surefire way to do that. Ensure that public funds pay only for public schools. And that's a lesson we could listen to in Australia as well. Back to you, Jean.
Well, that, of course, is a very interesting example of how when you have a country with many different faiths, you should treat them all equally and not give them any state money at all, because religion is a matter of personal conscience. It should not be a state matter. And the Dogs feel very strongly about this. We believe in the separation of religion from the state. It is actually in our constitution in section 116, but it was read down and out in 1981 by our High Court. But that's another story which you can find on our website. But for the moment, we're now going further overseas with Jeff.
Good afternoon, listeners. So what do chickens have to do with public education or with private education, any education? Well, you'll have to stay tuned to find out. But first, we're going to start in with a story from Florida by Sue Kingery-Waltansky, which originally appeared in her blog, but it's reposted on the Network for Public Education, and it was dated the 7th of November. And she writes, "Florida's state board is poised to ratify Heritage's Phoenix Declaration." She writes, "Florida contemplates one more step in the ideological takeover of public education." Sue Kingery-Waltansky explains why the Phoenix Declaration is bad news for American values. "A blueprint for ideological control and the next phase in dismantling public education." "Next week," she writes, "Florida's appointed Commissioner of Education and his ideologically aligned State Board of Education will vote to ratify and adopt the Phoenix Declaration, the Heritage Foundation's vision for education. The move cements Florida's march towards a full ideological takeover of its public schools. This should come as no surprise." In August, newly appointed board chair Ryan Petty, in his very first action, proposed adopting the Phoenix Declaration as a framework for our work here as members of the Florida State Board of Education, he told his colleagues. We live in a time of moral and political crises when too many schools have lost their way, he says. But this moment of challenge is also a moment of opportunity. If approved, Florida will become the first state to formally sign on to the Declaration. At this point, the board might well wear Heritage Foundation patches on their uniforms. Both Petty and former Commissioner Manny Diaz Jr. are listed among the Declaration's signatories alongside organisations such as the 1776 Project Foundation, United States Christian Education Network, Centre for Christian Virtue, and individuals from Mums for Liberty, PragerU, and others. It reads like a who's who of far-right education influences, from privatisation advocates like Erica Donalds and Corey DeAngelis, a contributor to Project 2025, to Christian nationalists such as Scott Yenner of Society for American Civic Renewal, SACR, and the Claremont Institute. On the surface, the Phoenix Declaration sounds relatively harmless. Like Petty, it opens with the claim that America faces moral and political crises in education, asserting that schools have lost their way. It outlines broad feel-good principles like parental choice, objective truth, character formation, cultural transmission, and citizenship, all framed in the language of virtue and tradition. But underneath that polished rhetoric lies a clear ideological agenda. As education blogger writer Peter Green observed, the Phoenix Declaration is artfully done. Much of it uses broad enough terms that everyone can agree with what it says, even though they totally disagree about what it means. It blows its anti-woke dog whistle hard enough to waken the oldest, deafest Labrador. But mostly, it assumes that all reasonable Americans see it this way, and while it name-checks civil disagreement at one point, it doesn't particularly embrace pluralism or diversity as American virtues or values. Still think this is just a harmless framework? Consider Heritage Foundation President Kevin Roberts' own words when unveiling the plan. He said, "For too long, education freedom advocates have been on the defence, constantly reacting to the radical left's latest ideological assault. It's time to go on offence. School leaders, educators, board members and policymakers need a set of shared, unshakable principles to reclaim education and put students, not leftist activism, first." In other words, Heritage is explicitly positioning the Phoenix Declaration as part of a political campaign to reclaim education, not a neutral statement of values. Historian Tad Stormer has described it as a sophisticated rebranding of culture war politics, using lofty rhetoric about virtue and excellence to conceal an authoritarian nationalist agenda aimed at censoring diverse histories and undermining public education. He identifies five key dangers. One, ideological control disguised as reform. It hides a political agenda behind the language of excellence and virtue. Two, rewriting and sanitising history. It promotes a selective patriotic version of US history that erases uncomfortable truths. Three, patriotism as indoctrination. It replaces informed citizenship with unquestioning nationalism. Four, the parental rights Trojan horse. It uses parental choice as a cover for censorship and defunding public schools. Five, the myth of objective truth. It defines truth through ideology, excluding dissenting perspectives. Stormer concludes, the Phoenix Declaration lays the groundwork for dismantling American education under the guise of reform. The erosion of public education, the attacks on historical integrity, and the narrowing of acceptable narratives are all part of this broader dogmatic assault. In Florida, that agenda already feels well underway, but should it be formally adopted and ratified by our state board? Absolutely not. Realistically, what can we do? As Stormer urged, expose the agenda. This is my attempt to do that. And he goes on to encourage people to share the piece and to contact members of the Board of Education in Florida if you're anywhere near Crawford University next Thursday. So that's the end of the article. Publicly, education belongs to all of us. Let's try to keep it that way, he finishes with. And that's the end of that little argument. But it's funny how the Phoenix Declaration is supposedly the nom de guerre of the Christian right in attacking education in the States, the Phoenix Declaration. Now, we're going to go to the story where a chicken is involved with education. And how so, you might ask? Well, this story is spreading wildly a few days ago. This particular article is from India Today by Unati Gusain, who's a sub-editor at India Today. And she writes, Mark Zuckerberg opened a secret school in his house for 30 students. Neighbours called it illegal. Mark Zuckerberg, she writes, has closed his unlicensed private school in Palo Alto following years of neighbour complaints. According to the reports, Zuckerberg was schooling around 30 or 40 students. Even Silicon Valley's... Oh, this came from November 7th, by the way. Even Silicon Valley's most powerful figure has learned that zoning laws don't bend easily. After 4 years of complaints, investigations and furious late-night emails, Mark Zuckerberg has finally been forced to shut down an unlicensed private school operating inside his lavish Palo Alto compound. The Meta CEO's secretive project, affectionately named after one of his family's pet chickens, sparked a full-blown neighbourhood rebellion. The school, known as the Bicken Ben School, has quietly been running since 2021, serving around 30 to 40 children in a Montessori-style program. It all started innocently enough. Neighbours in Palo Alto's exclusive Crescent Park area began noticing cars pulling up each morning to drop off children at Zuckerberg residence. What at first looked like a playgroup quickly raised eyebrows. Residents soon realised that the Meta boss was running with what he appeared to be a fully-fledged school without the necessary city permits. By 2022, whispers turned into organised outrage. Neighbours accused the city of showing Zuckerberg special treatment and ignoring repeated code violations. We find it quite remarkable that you are working so hard to meet the needs of a single billionaire family while keeping the rest of the neighbourhood in the dark, one furious resident wrote to the city's planning department in February. According to 1,665 pages of documents obtained by Wired, being an online journalist resource, years of complaints and construction chaos. The unlicensed school wasn't the first issue to annoy Crescent Park locals. For nearly a decade, residents had battled constant construction, expanding security operations and growing noise levels at the Zuckerberg estate. The Meta founder had reportedly acquired 11 properties in the area to build his massive compound, complete with private guards who followed city inspectors around. This appears to be more than a homeowner with a security fetish, wrote building inspection manager Corwin Peck in a December 2020 email after describing SUV riding guards monitoring his visits. When formal complaints about the school reached city officials in 2024, tensions boiled over. One neighbour wrote that the school was expanding despite numerous neighbourhood complaints and multiple code violation reports, according urging the city to issue a cease and desist order. City diplomacy backfires. In a bid to defuse the situation, Palo Alto planning director Jonathan Late initially floated what he described as a nuanced solution that would allow some educational activities to continue temporarily. That attempt at compromise went down badly. Would I or any other homeowner be giving the courtesy of a nuanced solution if we were in violation of the city code for over 4 years? One angry resident shot back. Behind closed doors, Zuckerberg's legal team scrambled to keep the school open. Christine Wade, an attorney from the SSL law firm, argued that classes counted as appropriate residential use. The team even explored converting the operation into a state-licensed large family daycare, which would have sidestepped local oversight, but that plan never moved forward. The city finally steps in. In early 2025, Officials had run out of patience. In March, the city issued a June 30 deadline for the Bick and Ben school to shut down or face legal action. Neighbours, however, were still sceptical. "Please know that you have not earned our trust," one resident warned in an email, "and we'll certainly take every opportunity to hold the city accountable." According to state records, the school officially closed in August 2025, though a Meta family spokesperson, Brian Baker, insisted that it had merely relocated. The new site has not been disclosed, leaving the locals to wonder whether the operation has simply moved out of sight. Palo Alto spokesperson Megan Horrigan-Taylor defended the city's approach, telling Wired that officials enforce zoning, building and the life safety rules consistently without regard to who owns the property. "The Bick and Ben saga is a rare case of Silicon Valley wealth colliding head-on with local bureaucracy and losing. For Zuckerberg's neighbours, it is a satisfying victory after years of noise, traffic and what they saw as preferential treatment. The dispute also highlights a broader question hanging over Silicon Valley. When billionaire ambition meets community rules, who wins? For once, it wasn't the tech titan." So there you go. Bick and Ben being the name of Mark Zuckerberg's chicken. Let's hope he hasn't got another school named after his pet cow or anything else that he'd like to incorporate into his idea of education. As these billionaires do what they like, running wild in the States. With that, I'm going to leave you and wish you well and have a lovely afternoon. Cheerio, back to the headquarters of the dogs. Bye-bye.
Yes, well, we've finished now with the bad news, I suppose, and we're coming back for all the good news. So we're having a break, so stick with the dogs and come back for the good news of the day.
You're listening to 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM. Visit the 3CR website at 3cr.org.au/podcast to hear the most recent recording from each show, or 3cr.org.au/streaming to listen live.
Panoply, panorama, panpipe, pansy, aha, pansexual. Knowing no boundaries of sex or gender. Sound interesting? Then join Sally on Sundays at noon for Out of the Pan. All those gender questions making you think too hard? Whether it's transgender, bisexual, polyamorous or beyond, we'll throw those questions into the pan and cook up the answers for you. So go on, push that gender envelope, only on 3CR 855am digital and 3cr.org.au.
Well, we hope you're still listening to the Dogs program because we want to tell you about the natives who are getting very restless, particularly the teachers in both Tasmania and Victoria. The New South Wales teachers have also been out and about, but we're going to bring you some news from the teachers in Tasmania who had an interesting protest. And next week, if you tune into the Dogs, you'll find out about a very interesting protest here in Melbourne itself. So let's hear from Tasmania, shall we?
Thank you very much. I had full intention to write a very passionate speech, but unfortunately I am a teacher and the week has gotten away from me. On Monday, I brought my lunch in. I put it in my office in my fridge and I am yet to eat it. It is now Thursday. Last night, I worked until 9 p.m. I was calling parents until 6 o'clock, emailing until 8 o'clock, sorting out things for today until 9 o'clock. That is not unusual and it is not okay. People who work in education know how dire it is. I've been teaching for 10 years, and that is 5 years past my expected career as a teacher. I'm 32 years old, and I've exceeded it by 5 years. That is not okay. When we voted on what mattered, what we wanted to take to the government in our negotiations, pay was not highly ranked. What matters to us is our working conditions, and our working conditions are not safe. The reason that we are a young crowd is because this job is not sustainable. The workload that we are given is not sustainable. Yeah. Over 10 years, every single year that I've taught, the government adds more and more things to our plate, more expectations, more limits. The only thing they don't add is time. And they know it. The one thing I want you to take away from today is the government knows how hard your job is. The government knows how to fix it. And the issue is they don't care enough to do that because they know it costs money. Years ago, one of my best friends works at the Department of Education in Victoria. He's still there. His job was to recruit teachers. And he asked me, Jake, what is something that we can do? What would get you back into teaching? What would take university students out of other degrees to get them into teaching? And I said, who cares about that? What you need to do is you need to fix our workload. You need to fix behaviour. You need to make schools safe for us to be in, and then you wouldn't have to replace those teachers. And you know what he said to me? He looked at me with a face of pity, as if I didn't understand. And he said, Jake, you know we know that, but they just don't care. They know, they can predict, they have the data. They know there is a teacher shortage years before it happens because they can see the numbers are going up and the numbers coming in are going down. What they care about is that they had enough people, young teachers, doing $40,000 master's degrees to only teach for 3 years, coming in into the meat grinder to replace the people leaving. It's not that there aren't enough teachers. There are thousands of teachers in Tasmania. Nobody wants to teach. There is rising classroom violence. I have been assaulted 4 times in the last 3 years.
Shame! Twice this week!
Shame! Our Tier 3 and our Tier 4 programs are unsupported. They're underfunded. We have students committing crimes, being sent to Ashley Detention Centre, major violent crimes, and they're expected to be back in mainstream classes 3 to 4 weeks later. That is not okay. Our TAs should be paid what they deserve. Our TAs should not be expected to budget before Christmas, to be picking up jobs in summer. Our TAs need to be respected, and that is a career choice. It is not a casual job to be picked up 8 months at a time. That is not okay. They're quite happy to give themselves a pay rise. We know that. They're quite happy to throw money at things like TT line and the stadium. But every single year, their budget gets higher and higher. Nothing like the costs they're expected to be. But there's not enough money for you. There's not enough money to pay you through summer. The government knows that we care and they use that against us. They know that you are going to spend your weekends, your public holidays and your afternoons working when you shouldn't because you care. When you want to give their children opportunities like excursions, good learning environments, you will do that in your free time. They know you will do that because you care. They are weaponising our compassion against us. We put up with conditions that we shouldn't because we care. Every single person is here because we care. But this is not the final step. This is just the beginning. The Rockcliffe government needs to know that we will continue with industrial action until we get a fair go, and they are not willing to give it to us. You need to know that. We have to fight for this. This isn't about money. This is about making our jobs safe. This is about making our jobs a career instead of a blip in our life. Teachers shouldn't teach for 5 years. We spent 5 years in university to have a 5-year career. That's not okay. Thank you.
Well, that was a very passionate teacher, wasn't it? We like to keep the passion alive here on 3CR. But there's been a bit of passion in a very, very interesting brand new school up there in the northwest of Melbourne. where they're following Swedish practice. Over in Sweden, they believe in making sure their children are well fed, because they know well fed children are able to learn so much better. And here there's a Melbourne school who's hired a chef. Let's hear about it.
Thanks, Jean. A Melbourne public school hired a chef. It was an instant hit with students and parents. And this was published in The Age on October the 29th, written by Bridie Smith. A simple but delicious tradition has formed at the new Werri-Jerri Primary School in Melbourne's north. Each day, students and staff sit down together around trestle tables and eat a hot lunch. It's based on the Scandinavian meals model, where healthy food is prepared on site by a chef. And while the Swedish meatballs may have been replaced with lamb kofta, the idea is the same. The decades-old model is designed to ensure students eat healthy meals, become more adventurous with the food they eat, and hone their social skills. It encourages a different type of conversation and socialisation. It's a really considered time to build that sense of belonging, Principal Beck Spink said. Spink introduced the practice after touring four schools in Finland and Sweden last year, keen to use it as a way to build community at the new school in Wollert, on Melbourne's northern fringe. Berrima Public School in New South Wales' Southern Highlands piloted a similar lunch program last year. An evaluation by Flinders University found the program improved eating habits at the school and at home, and saw greater socialisation across year levels, with older students taking on mentoring roles with younger students. In Sweden and Finland, all primary school-aged children receive free school meals. The meals must adhere to strict national nutritional standards. A 2021 study found the Swedish policy, rolled out in the 1950s and 60s, increased lifetime income by 3% for students who received free meals throughout their primary school years. Children from poorer households benefited the most. The boost to lifetime income attributed to the lunch program was likely due to its positive impact on early adult health and educational attainment, the researchers found. Spink said she initially asked parents about their children's favourite meals and then shared the results with chef Mike Galtenfenzi, who works full-time in the school's commercial-scale kitchen. Galtenfenzi now makes lunch each day for 115 students and 29 staff. Every meal, from spaghetti bolognese to butter chicken and mac and cheese, contains vegetables. There are also halal and vegetarian options, and most Monday meals are meat-free. A morning tea of fresh fruit and a grab-and-go snack for afternoon tea are also provided. Prep student Lucas Goh gave the spaghetti bolognese with a side of broccoli a 5-star review. "This food makes my tummy happy," he said. Amel Idris's son Noah is also in prep. She said the program had made a difference to his attitude towards food. "He's been trying new things and becoming more confident with his eating," she said. For fellow parent Zamira Fijzule, the program's best part was no longer having to make school lunches. "Lunchboxes are tricky to pack, as the kids get over the same style of food every day," she said. "Not having to make lunch has made our school mornings less rushed, and we can actually spend that time focusing on having a good brekkie together." Back to you, Jane.
Well, there's no doubt what is going to be our great state school of the week this week. Let Andy tell us all about it.
Every week on the Dogs Program, we have a special segment to show a different state school is a great school.
State schools are great schools.
School of the week. State school.
School of the week.
Great state schools.
State schools.
School of
the week. School for the week here on the Dogs Program.
And this week's great state school of the week is Werri-Jerri Primary School. This new primary school in Wollert, north of Epping in northern Melbourne, opened in 2025, helping the growing local population get great education close to home. The school is open for enrolments for students in prep to grade 6. Beck Spink was appointed as the first principal of the school. The school was known by its interim name, Wollert Central Primary School, during planning and design. Werri-Jerri Primary School was chosen as this new school's name following community and traditional owner group consultation. Werri-Jerri is a Woiwurrung word of the Wurundjeri people, meaning messenger. Historically, the Werri-Jerri was a key figure who conveyed important messages and invitations between Aboriginal groups, often carrying a message stick. This role symbolises communication and connection, embodying our school's core principles of respect, curiosity and collaboration. Just as the Wiradjuri facilitated communication and understanding between different groups, Wiradjuri Primary School aims to foster a community where these values are central to everything we do. The Wiradjuri ethos is woven into the fabric of our school, inspiring open communication, fostering deep connections and collaboration, and promoting respectful exchange among students, staff, families, and the wider community. Since this is a brand new school, there are no figures on the ACARA website, but the Victorian Government website indicates the following. The school includes an administration and library building, three learning neighbourhoods, and a community hub, hard courts, a car park, and a sports field. And there's a kindergarten on site. The kinder will be run by the City of Whittlesea and will open in 2026. It will be able to offer kinder to 99 children at a time. It may be able to enrol more local kids by spreading classes throughout the week. Locating the kinder at the school will help some families before and after school with drop-off and pick-up. It will also help some children make a smoother transition into primary school. And funding, in the 2023-24 state budget, the school received a share of $573 million. Back to you, Jean.
Well, congratulations to Wiradjuri Primary School up there, in a brand new area with all of those lovely new houses and very minimal resources, I suppose, but they've got a school. And now our time is gone. If you want to find out more about the dogs, you can at our website at www.adogs.info. And I'd like to thank Dale and Perofsider, Andy and Jeff and Sorrel. But from all of us at 3CR, hoping that you'll tune in next week to hear about the wonderful protest held up in Heidelberg last Wednesday. I'm now saying bye for now.
I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. Says I, am standing by my bed. They framed you on a murder charge, says Joe, but I'm dead. Says Joe, but I'm dead. The copper bosses killed you, Joe. They shot you, Joe, says I. Takes more than guns to kill a man, says Joe, I didn't die, says Joe, I didn't die. And standing there as big as life and smiling with his eyes, says Joe, what they can never kill, went on to organize, went on to organize. From San Diego up to Maine, in every mine and mill, where workers strike and organize, it's there you'll find your hill. It's there you'll find. Saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he.
Says he.
Thanks for listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We rely on the financial support of listeners like yourself to keep going. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au and thanks for your support.